Blog Talk Radio.
She's just a girl and she's on fire, hotter than a fantasy, lonely like a highway. She's living in a world and it's on fire, filled with catastrophe, but she knows she can fly away.
Now,
black folks didn't hang black folks, white folks hanged black folks. So I just want to share that with you tonight. And that was Alicia Keys. Because of the black woman, we have survived. Not the black, but the black women have carried this fight. Black, right here in Chicago, we got a black mayor, black state attorney, black federal attorney. So we got blacks running Chicago. We might not like it, but the black women and women at large has been there fighting. And with all this killing going on over in Russia, the women and the babies, they're moving out the way. I want to thank Sister Pearl for her testimony and Mary DeRee, because this is a group for black women. And I said women, but it's women have come far, and they're still moving up further. So it's good to talk about racism, white supremacy, racism on the women. I ain't talking about no drag queens or real women. I'm talking about drag women, real women, women that are women that was born by God, a woman. You ain't talking about the drag mess. The drag mess is the devil. But the women, you talk about in the till, Mary Edwards, talk about Rosie Parks, you talk about all the black women down in Mississippi that made it happen. Those women are honored, I say today, as our ancestors. These are the women that have your mother, your great-grandmother. Somebody said, I want to go back there. I don't want to go to Africa. My grandmother got me here. My grandmother pulled corn here. So y'all go to Africa, y'all want to. But I am American, indigenous American. What that means, I was born here. I'm going to die here. And I'm going to make this work. It's good to know that your great ancestors come from Africa. But I know nothing about Africa. You know nothing about Africa. What I'm saying, when people come over from Africa, they get the benefit. That's for me and you. And those people coming over, now stop saying I'm an African. You say I'm a Disney black. That means that you're here. You ain't went nowhere you was here. So then you got to take care of the Disney black first. That means that we have to have reparations. Everybody else gets reparations. They cut the oil off and all that. Gas up to $5, $7 a gallon. Just pay us what you owe us. Just give us what our ancestors picked cotton for, pulled corn for, and sugar cane down in Louisiana, and tobacco. Give us that money. We ain't the worst. That's one thing that I'm saying tonight. We're honoring black women. This is a women's month. We had just got out of Black History. But because of women, we have moved up a step further. Because of black women, we have moved forward. I'm telling you, if it wasn't for black women, what would we be at? God will keep you. Talking about how black women made things happen, and black women, that's, I guess, your mother, your great-grandmother that did things. The women were over at the University of Chicago, Chicago State, and they were talking about how women have been pushed aside. And if it wasn't no, if it, preachers wouldn't have nobody, wouldn't no women in the church, because the women run the church. Hello? So if the women work out the church, the preacher ain't gonna have nobody. So we talked about black women's, and they passed the bill after 100 years. They just passed the bill. It's illegal to hang black folks. It's a government crime now. Look how many people have been hung and shot. And it just now, and the Congress was so racist, they veto the bill every time. That's going to show you. I want to thank Bobby Rush for wanting to put the bill forward. And Biden supposed to sign the bill to make it a criminal law, a hate crime, somebody being hung. Now, we'd have 45 people being hung, okay, 45,000 people being hung in young America. And we have 1,000 here been hung right here in Illinois. And I don't know how many was hung in Michigan. I just looked up Illinois. But throughout this country, blacks being hung, because this ain't talking about burnt them, I just hung. There's 1,000 here in Illinois was hung. Okay, we going back. Then when you look over the whole United States, 45,000 people was hung. It wasn't white folks, it was black folks. It should wake you up, stop the killing, save the baby. We still shooting each other. If more people getting killed in Chicago and also, I'm going to say in Illinois, Michigan, Minnesota, Arkansas, Mississippi, Georgia, Atlanta. Then over there in Afghanistan, where they fighting at? 500 got killed, and they dropping bombs and tanks. Over the weekend, we have over 500 killed, black on black. You know, that's going to show you. Young lady today come to the gas station, she got shot. Trying to jack her car. Car raggedy, new car. Where you can go? Gas, $500, $700. $500, gas a gallon, $5, going up to $7, $8, you can hijack a car. That's stupid. That's dumb criminals. They dumb criminals. They need to get some education. That's what I'm going to say to that. But the wrath of God is going to catch them, and I ain't going to feel sorry for them, okay? They dumb children, and their mamas and daddies have no charge over them. Like I said, these are some of the evil people that was come through that. When I tell you about the giants, when I tell you that the angels had sex with common people, and they brought giants. Giants had sex with women, and they had evil. This is some of the evil women and children that's robbing and killing. And mom and daddy got no control. They kill mom and they kill daddy. But they have no control of them. They're going to die a horrible death. The wages of sin is death, the gift of God, eternal life. We're lifting up our black women tonight. I'm going to have Mary to read the 23rd number of Psalm. And I'm going to have prayer to be a testimony. Some of you might have a testimony. Okay. Mary Hawkins, you're on the phone. You can read the 23rd number. This is women. This is Women's Day. It's honor all women that the struggle women have did and how they have come forward. And I said this all the time. It wasn't for the black woman going in kitchen and white folks' kitchen working, bringing food home to her children. We as a race wouldn't make it. So the black woman have always been on this, always working to motivate her family. Even when they built the project, and it was a project, you know what they did? They put the women in there and told the women, your husband can't come now. So that the project was to divide up the black family, because if they catch you got a man in your house in the project, they kick you out. You know what I'm saying? That was a project from the government. If you know they had project in Chicago, that project in Minnesota, because I'm going to the project. It was a project by the government. And the project was to see how you can make it when they got 4,000-5,000 people stacked up to the 16th floor, 10 buildings.
No, down here.
They was checking to see what was happening to black folks. We saw that. But that was the first time I lived in the project. The name was project. It was a government project. Over in
Tennessee.
It took 3 or 4 years. Kind of test their blood and see was they super, stuff like that. We're going to have Sister Mary to read the 23rd number song. Go on, Sister Mary, read.
Okay, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me to lie down in green pastures. He leadeth me beside the still waters. He restored my soul. He leadeth me in the path of righteousness for his name's sake. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me, thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of my enemies. Thou anoints my head with oil, my cup running over. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. I read Psalm, the number of Psalm 20. The 23rd number of Psalm.
Psalm 23, for that, okay. It's Sister Pearl. You woke Sister Pearl up. I want to make sure she do a testimony. But this is Black Women's Day and Black Women's Week, so we have to tell the story of what's going on as we cross over. Because when we cross over, we can talk about Rosa Parks. We can talk about Martin Luther King, White, Coretta Scott King, and we can talk about others that had problems in our ancestors. So we got to deal with that, what's going on in the hurry. But we're talking about black women and what black women contribute to what's going on. And like Lisa Keys sung this song, she got a book out now. And the women's is on fire. Black men's gonna stop. I'm gonna play.
She's just a girl and she's on fire, hotter than a fantasy, lonely like a highway. She's living in a world and it's on fire, filled with catastrophe, but she knows she can fly away.
Doing a good job And I want to tell you, if you out there, you're on drugs, you're on the prostitution road, we can pray for you. If you out there and you think you're a man and you're a woman, we'll pray for you. Women have come too far. We're going to talk about the new Jim Crow. This is at the University of Chicago. And the young lady that spoke today, I want to play her because she talked about the drugs and talk about how we come to a fuck.
Black and brown school children, not just white children, killed by deranged mass murderers. But I am deeply disturbed that in this national debate about violence and gun control, there is little honest discussion of why, truly why, some communities are war zones while others are not. While I support gun control and background checks and all the rest, let me be very clear about that, I think we've got to admit, even if some communities are war zones, some are not, it's not at bottom about the number of guns in those communities. After all, I live in a community where I've come to learn that many of my white neighbors my neighborhood. At bottom, what makes the community safe is not the number of guns, but the number of good schools, the number of good jobs, the number of educational opportunities, the number of opportunities you have for living a decent life. Those are the numbers that matter most when it comes to violence. And in Chicago, and so many other cities and communities across America, a choice has been made. It is a deliberate choice. And it is a choice that has been made over and over and over again. Rather than good schools, we have been willing to build high-tech schools. Rather than create jobs and invest in the communities that need it most, we have embarked on an unprecedented way to incarcerate that has left millions of Americans locked up. William Julius Wilson has written an excellent book about the changes that occurred in Chicago and other communities around the country entitled Living Work Disappears. And in that book, he cites statistics showing that when you control for job movements, the racial disparities and violent crime disappear. In other words, if you compare white jobless men, black jobless men, rape and violent crime are roughly men who are jobless, particularly chronically jobless, are more likely violent. A jobless is not violent. Most people who are jobless do not resort to violence. But what we know, and what is still secret, is that are plagued by exceedingly high levels of joblessness are likely to be violent. But a shift occurred here in Chicago and in communities across America, urban communities, beginning in the late 50s, early 60s, to the 1970s, work disappeared. It used to be that factories would be located in urban areas, segregated black communities, so those factories could have easy access to cheap black labor. In fact, as late as 1970, more than 70% of all African Americans working in the Chicago area held blue collar jobs, factory jobs. Almost overnight, those jobs vanished. By 1987, the industrial employment of black men had plummeted to 28%. Industrialization, globalization, technological advancement, factories closing jobs, jobs moving overseas, hundreds of thousands of people. Black men found themselves suddenly jobless, trapped in racially segregated, jobless communities. Trapped. training, particularly to young people coming up in these communities, so they could make the rough transition from an industrial economy to a service-based economy. But no, chose a different road, a road more familiar when it comes to matters of race. We chose the road of division, punitiveness, and despair. We, the society, ended the war on poverty, declared the war on drugs. Black men found themselves suddenly disposable, no longer necessary to the functioning of the U.S. economy, precisely at the same moment that a backlash was brewing against the civil rights movement, a backlash that was convenient for politicians to demonize black men. Unwilling to work. So this war on drugs was declared, and black men found that they were no longer needed to work in the field, no longer needed to labor in factories, and they found themselves pawns and games, the enemy in a new war. Bounded up by the millions. Locked up and then permanently locked out. Now, decades later, we stand back and say, what's wrong with these people? Why are they killing each other? Why is there so much violence that we have abandoned? Communities where good schools cannot be found, but high-tech prisons are a drive away. What's wrong with them? I think the deeper question, the more profound question, is what is wrong with us? Why have we been silent for so long? Well, I've been asked to the thesis of my book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration and the Age of Colorblindness, and I think the title of the book pretty much speaks for itself. I argue that today, in the so-called era of colorblindness, and yes, even in the age of Obama, and even right here in Obama's hometown, something akin to a caste is alive and well in America. The mass incarceration of poor people of color in the United States can amount to a new caste system when it shuttles our children from decrepit underfunded to these brand new high-tech prisons. System that locks poor people, overwhelmingly people of color, into a permanent second-class status, nearly as effectively as the earlier systems of racial and social control. In my view, this system is the moral equality of Jim Crow. Now, I'm always very willing, very happy to admit sometimes that I didn't think this way, that I rejected this kind of talk out of hand. Time when I viewed advocates and activists who were calling the drug war, mass incarceration, new Jim Crow, I thought they were exaggerating, engaging in hyperbole. In fact, there was a time when I thought that people who made those kinds of claims and those kinds of comparisons were actually doing more harm than good in efforts to harm our criminal justice system, greater racial equality in the United States. But I finally woke up. And I woke up after years of working as a civil rights lawyer and advocate, representing racial profiling and police brutality, and investigating patterns of drug law enforcement for communities of color, and attempting to assist people who had been released from prison as they faced one closed door after another, one legal barrier to their supposed re-entry. After another. Trying to assist people re-enter into society that had never shown much for them in the first place. And I had a experience that began what I call my awakening. I began to awaken to the reality. And our criminal justice system now functions more like a system of racial control than a system of crime. mind, it is no longer socially permissible to use race explicitly as a justification for discrimination and social contempt. So we don't. Rather than rely on race, we use our criminal justice system to make people of color criminal and then engage in all the practices of today, it is perfectly legal to discriminate against criminals all the way. It's illegal to discriminate against African Americans. Labeled a felon in all forms of discrimination. Employment discrimination, housing discrimination, denial of the right to vote, jury service, suddenly legal. As a criminal, you have scarcely more rights, arguably less respect, than a black man living in Alabama at the height of Jim Crow. That ended racial caste in America is nearly redesigned. It took a while to get to that place. And like a lot of people, I was in deep denial. Even as I was working as a social advocate, as a civil rights lawyer, I thought I knew what was going on. I was disturbed. I was even appalled by high numbers of black men cycling in and out of our prison jails, but I thought, that's explained by the high-risk poverty, bad homes, legacy of inequality. Somehow it didn't occur to me that black folks, for a long, long time, not educated for a long, long time, but nothing like the mass incarceration had ever existed before. Somehow it was rationalized. What I saw, because of the prevailing myth about the system of mass incarceration, fed to us in countless ways, I was fed in many sets of models, and that were fed media. But I had one experience that finally began to open my eyes. It shook me to my core. It was a young African-American man who was about 19 years old. Walked into my office, forever changed the way I viewed justice, but how I viewed myself as a civil rights lawyer and advocate. At the time, I was directing the Racial Justice Project in California. We had just launched a major campaign against racial profiling by the police. We called it the DPD campaign, or the Driving While Black or Brown campaign. And we had created a hotline number for people to call if they believed they were stopped or targeted by the police on the basis of race. And put this hotline number up on billboards in Oakland, San Jose, and Sacramento, urging people to call the hotline number if it's stopped or targeted by the police. And in fact, within the first 6 minutes, we announced the hotline number on the east, calls crashed temporarily. We had to expand our capacity volume of calls. So I was spending my day interviewing one young black brown man after another, called the hotline for discriminatory stop or search abuse by the police. And it was very late in the day, late in the afternoon, and I was tired. I was eager to go through yet another round of interviews. And this young man walks in carrying a stack of papers, thick stack of papers about him. He had taken detailed notes of his encounters with the police in Oakland. Over about a 9-month period of time, he had descriptions of every stop, every frisk, every time his car was pulled over and searched. He had descriptions of every encounter as well as witnesses, who was there, robbery, what the police said, what they did. On top of that, he had names of officers, some even badge numbers of officers. He just had an unbelievable amount of documentation detail about his pattern of stops, searches, harassment he had been experiencing by the police. And the stories telling were corroborated by other stories we had heard coming out of his neighborhood about what the police were doing there. And I started thinking to myself, well, maybe he's the one. Maybe he could be our named plaintiff in class action suit, planning to file against the Oakland Police Department alleging man. He'll do well in the media. The jury will like him. He's outspoken. A one. And then he said something to me, pause, and said, what did you say? You're a drug dealer? Actually, it's screen people with felony records. When people would call our hotline number, we would send a form to them to fill out asking them a bunch of questions about their experiences, including, have you ever been convicted of a felony? He believed we couldn't represent someone as a team plaintiff in a racial profiling suit if they had been convicted of a felony, because we knew that if we did, law enforcement and the media would be all over us saying, well, of course, the police should be keeping their eye on him. He's a felon. He's a criminal. And we knew that we wouldn't be able to put someone with a felony record on the stand as a plaintiff in a racial profiling case without them cross-examined for an hour in front of the jury about a prior criminal history that distracts the jury's attention away from law enforcement conduct and turning it into a trial about prior criminal past. And so treating people with prior criminal records, he's not busted it on his form. Check the metaphorical box. And so I'm sitting there looking at him. Did you just say you're a drug seller? He gets quiet and he says, finally, yeah. No, I'm a drug fell. I'm a drug fell. But let me tell you what happened to me. Let me tell you what happened. He had a drugs on me. He said at me and my friend, beat us up, framed us. He started telling me this long story about how he was framed by the police, landed drugs on them, love, and I'm just saying, I'm sorry. I'm not going to be able to represent you if you have a felony record. And I tried to explain to him why that was so I could understand that. I would seem unfair or wrong. He's trying to give me more information, more details. Now he's giving me the names of those officers, their badge numbers. Who can corroborate that? I'm sorry. I am not going to be able to represent you. They start insisting upon his innocence. I'm innocent. I'm telling you, I just took the police. Told me that I could just walk. I wouldn't know what happened to stay in prison if I just. Deal. I just get felony probation. Felony probation. And that's it. I was innocent, but I didn't want to spend the time. I was scared of going to prison. I just deal. But I'm telling you, I didn't deal with it. I'm telling you the truth. I am sorry. I cannot. And then he becomes says to me, you're no better than the police. You're no better than the police. Didn't I tell you I'm a felon? Stop listening. Can't even hear what I have to say. So what's going to become of me? What's he telling me? Because I can't stop anywhere because of my felony record. Anywhere. I can't even get housing. I can't even get access to public housing because of my drug felony. What am I supposed to do? You know, I sleep in my grandma's basement at night. Because nowhere else will take me in. So how am I supposed to take care of myself? As a man, I can't even get food stamps. I can't even get food stamps to feed myself. What's become of me? Good luck finding one young black man in my neighborhood. They haven't got. They've got to us all already. He snatches all those stuff, all those notes, starts ripping them up into tiny little pieces, throwing them in the air, and throwing white paper in my office. He walks out, better than me. A couple months after that, I'm doing a public access television show that was broadcasting live out of Houston. I was doing a public access show because we were trying to organize several thousand people to get on buses, go to the state capitol to protest the governor's assigned racial profiling legislation, holding town hall meetings up and down the state campaign. And it was a couple of days before the demonstration. I was doing public access meetings, trying to urge people to get on the bus for the demonstration. Well, immediately after that show was off the air, broadcasting live, and then this was off the air, shouldn't have treated you like that. I shouldn't have spoken to you like that. I would have bought you some flowers, but I still don't have any money, so I snatched the plant off my grandma's front porch. Hands at me. And then he turns around and takes off, running out of the building. And I go chasing after him, jumps into the broke down car, and disappears. Several months after that, in my office, they open up the paper. What's on the front page? The Oakland Raiders scandal is broken. Turns out that a gang of officers, otherwise known as a drug task force, have been planting drugs on suspects, picking folks up in his neighborhood, and who's identified as the main officer, one of the main officers charged with planting drugs on suspects and beating folks up? Well, it was the officer that he had identified planting drugs on him and his friend. And it really, only then, I'm embarrassed to say, only then the people finally started to go on to me. And I thought to myself, he's right about me. I am no better than he. The minute he told me he was a felon, I just stopped listening. I couldn't even hear what he had to say. That was the beginning of me asking myself hard questions. Myself as a civil rights lawyer and advocate. How am I actually replicating the very forms of discrimination, marginalization, and exclusion I'm supposed to fighting against? And I also started asking questions about the system itself. Why was it you hadn't been able to find a single black man from had gotten to you? What was really going on? And that was the beginning of my journey, asking myself and others a lot of hard questions, an enormous amount of questions, and listening more carefully to the stories of those psychics in and out of our prison system. And what I learned in that process was that my great crime wasn't in refusing to represent an innocent man. My great crime was in imagining that there was some path to justice that did not include those we view as guilty. And I also learned some facts of my mind. I learned there are more African-American adults under correctional control today, in jail, on probation, parole, that were enslaved in 1860, decades before the Civil War began. I learned that in 2004, more black men were disenfranchised than in 1870. The 15th Amendment was ratified, laws that explicitly deny the right to vote on the basis of race. Now, of course, during the Jim Crow era, active protests operated to keep black folks from the police. Well, today, in some states, felon disenfranchisement laws accomplished poll tax protests ultimately could not. A black child born today has less of a chance of being raised by both parents than a black child born during slavery. This is due to a small part to the mass incarceration of black men. The first article to appear in the mainstream press, I believe, about this is The Economist magazine, titled How the Mass Incarceration of Black Men Harms Black Women. And in the article, it explained that the majority of black women in the United States, about 70% of black professional women, are unmarried. But this is due largely to the mass incarcerated black men, which, out of the dating pool, the years they would be most likely to commit to a partner or to a but what's worse is that by branding them criminals and felons early ages, often before they're even old enough to vote, rendered permanently unemployable. The legal job market, for the most part, virtually guarantees that most will cycle in and out of prison, sometimes for the rest of their lives. Now, this isn't a phenomenon that affects a small segment of the African-American community. No, to the contrary, in major urban areas in the United States today, more than half working-age African-American men now have criminal records and are thus subject to legalized discrimination for the rest of their lives. recorded a number of years ago that here in Chicago, right here in Chicago, you take into account prisoners. You actually count them as people. And of course, you know, prisoners are excluded from poverty, unemployment, thus masking the severity of racial inequality. So you actually count prisoners as people in the Chicago area. Nearly 80% of working age African American men have criminal records and are thus subject to legalized discrimination for the rest of their lives. These men are part of a growing undercast, not class, caste, a group of people defined largely by race, relegated to a permanent second class status by law. I find that today when I tell people that I now finally believe that mass incarceration is like a new Jim Crow and Catholic system, people react to this and not that belief. How can you say that? How can you say the opposite of this? Is this a system of racial control? Is this a system of crime control? The black people just stop running around for so many times. You don't have to worry about being locked up and then stripped of your basic civil and human rights. Therein lies the great question about mass incarceration. Namely, it's been driven by crime and crime rates. It's just not true. Our prison population has quadrupled within a 30-year period of time. I've doubled or tripled it. Doubled within a 30-year period of time. We went from a prison population of roughly 300,000 to we're now have an incarcerated population of well over 2 million, the highest rate of incarceration in the world. During that 30-year period of time when our incarceration rates quintupled, crime rates in the United States fluctuated. It's been up, they went down, they went back up again, down again. Today, as bad as crime rates are, like Chicago, actually, crime rates are at historical lows. But incarceration, most criminologists and sociologists acknowledge that crime rates and incarceration rates in the United States have moved independently from each other. Incarceration rates, especially black incarceration rates, have soared regardless of whether crime is going up or down in each community or the nation as a whole. What explains such explosions in incarceration rates in terms of a prison system unprecedented and worldly increase? Not crime rates. The answer is the war on drugs and the intoxication that wave of abuse that washed over the United States. Drug addiction alone, accounted for about 2/3 of the increase in the federal prison system and more than half of the increase in the state prison system between 1985 and 2000. Our dramatic expansion. To get a sense of how large the contribution of drug money has made to mass incarceration, there are 4 people in prison and jail today just for drug offenses, and were incarcerated for all these things in 1980. Now, most Americans violate drug laws in their lifetime. You don't have to. But the enemy in this war, not by accident, this drug war has been exclusively in poor communities of color. Even though studies have consistently shown now for decades, contrary to popular belief, people of color are no more likely to use or sell illegal drugs than whites. But that defies our stereotypes about drug dealers. It's actually a study conducted on this subject in 1990 National Survey. People were asked, close your eyes, picture in your mind, and drug criminal. But 95% of respondents pictured an African American. But the 5% other race or ethnicity. Now, I know that many people would actually see this experience, see this data. Hey, yeah, that's a shame. That's a shame. But, you know, they need to stop on them. That's where the violent offenders are. That's where the things are. We need a war on them. In fact, in my friends, many people think about this war on drugs is considered to respond to the first respect of patient and pretending community and the related violence. That's a long time I was that, but it's just not true. The current drug declared by President Ronald Reagan in 1982, before crack began to grab the inner city community, on a wave of violence. President Richard Nixon was first deployed to federal war on drugs, but President Ronald Reagan turned that rhetorical war to a political one. And at the time he declared his drug war, drug crimes was actually up to this time, not on the rise. And less than 20% of the American population even identified with drugs as the nation's pressing concern. So why was Blair an all-out war on drugs? The drug crimes was actually finally not on the rise, and the public isn't too much concerned about it. The answer is with the outcome of the war on drugs has relatively little to do with genuine concern about drug addiction, the harms of drug abuse, and much to do with policy. Numerous historians recognize that now documents the war on drugs is part of the Rand Republican Party strategy, so it's a Southern strategy. On issues of crime and welfare, to appeal to poor and working class whites, particularly in the South, who are anxious about, resentful of, fearful of many games of African Americans in the civil rights movement. Now, I think we can be sincere. We have to acknowledge that poor and working class whites really had their own problems by the civil rights movement. The wealthy whites, there's all of these advantages that wealth has to offer. Of course, we're in the last place. Many of whom were themselves struggling for survival. Many of whom were themselves in the winter school. Many people in the social devotion. There, I think, was the subject. There came to themselves from someone on equal terms for limited jobs to all the groups on their whole lives to seek for inferior to them. And then, it matters worse from their perspective, affirmative action programs that black folks are now being taught to women. On their way to Stanford, Yale, Harvard, Chicago, and often corporate America, and this makes them appear. Fear, anger, resentment, anxiety, but also creating enormous political opportunities. Culture, got to sound so promising. Not successful time, but enormously successful in the choice of poor and working class whites to accept from the Democratic National Coalition and join the Republican Party. Part of the effort to flip south from the red, rhetoric and getting tough on crime and something else. Or the major opponent of President Richard Nixon's former chief of staff, he described it this way. The whole problem is really about class. He is divided system that recognizes this while not appearing to. Well, they did. And a couple of years after the Russell Wilson announced crack began to ravage the community. And the Reagan administration seized national development, actually hiring staff. The problem was to publicize crack babies, crack dealers, the whole crack wars and crack related violence. Many people appear to come to remember this. There was a time when our television sets were saturated. Crack babies, crack dealers, and images of black men, handcuffs, prostitutes, and courtrooms, and communities were swept mandatory minimum sentences for minor drug crimes, since the structure of the murder proceed and many other Western democracies.
We must also realize that the problems of racial injustice and economic injustice cannot be solved without a radical redistribution of political and economic power. We read one day, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But if a man doesn't have a job or an income, he has neither life nor liberty and the possibility for the pursuit of happiness. He merely exists.